Ao her oco e co ca aha. Inahe coliana imua o kea aha. Ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hano hano o kamoku aina o Hawaii. E nau e mai, e malio mai, i lohi ia kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 16812, Association of Apartment Owners of Kalele Kai versus Yoshikawa. Arguing for the petitioner, James W. Rooney. Arguing for the respondent, John D. Zaleski. Argument on the merits.
All right, good afternoon, aloha everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. During the proceeding, if one of the justices has a question, they'll raise their hand virtually and I'll call upon them at the earliest opportunity. I'd like to start today by asking our attorneys to introduce themselves and the order in which they'll be arguing.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Associate Justices. My name is James Rooney. I'm appearing on behalf of Mr. Yoshikawa.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, John Zaleski for the Association of Owners of Kalele Kai.
Thank you, Mr. Zaleski. So just to confirm, Mr. Rooney, we're going to give you, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have a light in awarding when you're 25 minutes into your initial argument. Mr. Zaleski, you've asked for a five-minute warning before the end of your argument, so we'll give you that as well. And then when we come to the end of both of your 30 minutes, we'll also, you'll hear a light, hear a tone and see a light as well. So please, with that, Mr. Rooney, if you'd like to proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Chief Justice. The issue before us is relatively narrow, and consequently, we will make our argument as concise as possible. Started with the broader issue being whether an award of attorney fees should be sua sponte affirmed and not subject to litigation on remand when the underlying order that gave rise to the fees is concurrently vacated and remanded. And the short answer to that is no. It results in an unjust outcome. Why should Mr. Yoshikawa have to pay opposing counsel's attorney's fees for bringing a premature motion for summary judgment that has been rightfully vacated and remanded? The result unjustly enriches opposing counsel, and Mr. Yoshikawa should not be responsible for such baseless fees. It's akin to a defendant in a criminal proceeding being convicted and sentenced, and thereafter having his conviction overturned, but still have to serve the outstanding remaining amount of his jail sentence. It doesn't make sense, and it's unjust, and the logic employed by the Intermediate Court of Appeals to arrive at this unjust outcome amounts to grave error. Also, the reasoning the Intermediate Court of Appeals employed to justify the use of their discretion in limiting the issues on remand is erroneous as well. Paragraph D of the Intermediate Court of Appeals opinion shows how they gravely erred in wrongfully utilizing their discretion when deciding Mr. Yoshikawa's appeal. The first sentence of paragraph D of the memorandum opinion order cites a case, Miyamoto versus Lum. It's 104 Hawaii 110 and 84. For the proposition that it's within the Intermediate Court of Appeals sound discretion to limit the issues to be decided on remand. However, the Miyamoto court was citing back to Kojima versus Ueda, 628 Pacific 2nd, 208, where that court only limited the issues on remand because of a finding that the issues were sufficiently separate from the other issues of the case. Moreover, the same paragraph at the end of paragraph D, the Intermediate Court of Appeals opinion, cites Costales versus Rossetti, 133 Hawaii at 453, in support of their affirming the attorney's fees associated with a motion for summary judgment, stating that limiting the damage issues to be retried to those that are contested and are sufficiently separate from those damages issues that are not contested on appeal. Here, the award of fees and the motion for summary judgment are not sufficiently separate from the only issue that Mr. Yoshikawa brought to the Intermediate Court of Appeals, being the motion for summary judgment.
Mr. Rooney, could you, what's your response to the IECA's reliance on Rule 28 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure? As I read their memorandum opinion, they're indicating that attorney's fees were not asserted as a point of error and that argument wasn't provided by Mr. Yoshikawa. Therefore, the potential point of error that fees were improperly awarded was waived. What's your response to that?
My response would be is Hawaii Rules of Appellate Procedure 28B4 also at the end provides the appellate court discretion to notice plain error. It's at its exclusive option. However, it's employed when justice so requires. And here I think there's such a nexus between the award of attorney's fees and the motion for summary judgment that it was clearly plain error that it was not raised in the appellate brief. And therefore, in the interest of justice, it should have been vacated along with the motion for summary judgment, Chief Justice.
Very well. Justice Wilson has a question followed by Justice Nakayama.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Rooney, it appears that the ICA has remanded clearly for further consideration of the motion for summary judgment. Could you explain what the status, therefore, is of the award of attorney's fees that are associated with the motion for summary judgment? Is it your understanding that the issue is no longer before the court? Or let's assume that the motion for summary judgment matter is litigated once again. Is it your understanding that at that time, the overall issue of attorney's fees in relation to the motion for summary judgment would be considered by the circuit court?
Thank you for the question, Justice Wilson. That would certainly be our hope that it would be redressed by the circuit court. And I believe a Rule 60B5 motion to vacate the judgment would be awarded at that time, as Hawaii Rules of Civil Procedure 60B5 expressly provides relief for judgments that are associated with other motions that have been vacated. My understanding of the opinion itself.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but then the relief that you're anticipating would be either that our court set aside the attorney's fees award for the summary judgment, or would you also be requesting as an alternative just a remand for further consideration of the issue of motion of the attorney's fees for motion for summary judgment once the matter has been decided by the circuit court?
Well, we would ask that you vacate the award of attorney's fees now to resolve the issue. However, in the alternative, yes, we would ask that you have it remanded to circuit court to be adjudicated there, Your Honor. And my understanding of the...
Mr. Rooney, Justice Nakayama had a question. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Rooney, I'm looking at in particular, I understand your argument regarding the motion for summary judgment and the attorney's fees that were awarded because of that. But what about the motion for protective order? The court awarded, and you know, I'm looking at the transcript, and there's a major disagreement as to whether Mr. Revere set the date just to have a date, and said he would be flexible, or according to Mr. Goodwin, said he wouldn't be flexible. But either way, and then there are two arguments. One, because two additional parties that you've cross-claimed on were not served yet and therefore didn't even have attorneys. And I understand Mr. Revere's argument was they were already represented by attorneys at the ARB. And the other one was don't let them conduct any discovery while the motion, at that point in time, was a motion to dismiss, was pending. Why should that fall? Why those attorney's fees weren't incumbent on the motion for summary judgment or the motion to dismiss? Those were incumbent on, the court determining that you weren't being flexible insofar as discovery. So why should those fees fall as a result of setting aside the summary judgment?
We concede, Justice, and I believe we did so in our writ, that the only issue that we're bringing for your honors today is the associated award of fees for the motion for summary judgment. And I believe that's under subsection 3 in the first amended final judgment. It's an award of $79,514.50, Your Honor. So we don't contest the other aspects of the final order, except the ones that exclusively pertain to the motion for summary judgment, because there's that nexus, that connection between them that makes it so fundamentally unfair that when the court vacated the motion for summary judgment, that they didn't vacate the associated fees with that motion. The rest of the issues that were remanded and not subject to litigation, we concede.
Justice McKenna has a question, Mr. Rooney.
Following up on Justice Nakayama's question, Mr. Rooney, so was the protective order granted just based on procedural scheduling issues? In other words, on remand, would you be able to take these depositions if you thought it was necessary to do so in terms of responding to any additional motions and or for in preparation of trial?
Thank you, Justice McKenna. We would hope so if it pertains to the remaining issues before the court. Yes.
All right. Justice Nakayama has a question. Justice Nakayama.
Mr. Rooney, I thought the terms of the protective order expired upon the entry of the motion, of the order granting the motion. Didn't expire?
You very well may have, Justice.
Oh, okay.
All right. Carry on, Mr. Rooney.
Very well. Thank you, Chief Justice. Again, here, the award of fees and the motion for summary judgment are not sufficiently separate from the only contested issue being the motion for summary judgment.
Justice McKenna has a question.
I'm sorry, Mr. Rooney. Do you think it is actually necessary for this court to invoke the plain error doctrine, or do you think that it appears that there are many cases nationwide holding that when the underlying judgment is set aside, any attorney's fees based on that judgment or order must also be set aside. So are you requesting an automatic holding, or are you requesting that we take plain error notice, since you didn't brief it, although you did appeal it?
Yes, Judge, we would ask that you find that the case law cited in paragraph D and the rulings around the country to limit the issue, Judge.
In other words, are you arguing that the attorney's fees were implicitly raised by your notice of appeal, or that's something that should be assumed that is in play if the underlying motion, because you invoke the plain error doctrine. I mean, another issue would be to whether we might have a different view from that of the ICA as to whether this issue was properly raised. Well, what's your thoughts on that, or would you say it does have to be plain error?
No, Chief Justice, I would not agree that it has to be plain error. I think that the misapplication of the case law, which is inconsistent with the rulings around the country, as Justice McKenna, I believe, appropriately pointed out, would be a basis alone to vacate them. The plain error doctrine is a more tenuous argument, Judge.
All right. Anything further at this point? I don't want to, if you have other issues or further argument, please go ahead.
I do, Judge. Thanks. As we all know, the award of attorney's fees was predicated on the motion for summary judgment, and that nexus and apparent connection and the relationship between the motion for summary judgment and fee order, they're so intertwined that the fee motion could not exist absent the motion for summary judgment that was rightfully vacated and remanded. Neither of the cases cited in paragraph D of the Intermediate Court of Appeals memorandum opinion supports affirming the award of fees while concurrently vacating the underlying motion for summary judgment. The two are not sufficiently separate as required by the case law cited here. And again, other courts around the country have ruled to the same. Again, the ICA, to exercise their discretion to facilitate such an unjust disposition, amounts to grave error. The last argument I have regarding this broader issue pertains to the reasoning behind which the fee orders were granted in the first place. Here, opposing counsel relied on both the statutory basis, Hawaii Revised Statutes 514B157, and the Association of Owners governing documents as prevailing parties that are entitled to the fees. However, under both of those provisions, non-prevailing parties must pay the other's fees. In other words, if you don't prevail, no fees. Here, the ICA determined that the appellate court had not met their burden of proof, that the appellee had not met their burden of proof to sustain their motion for summary judgment. Therefore, it logically follows that they didn't meet their burden of proof with respect to the fee motion. The award of fees is predicated upon prevailing and meeting your burden of proof under both the statutory sections and the AOAO's governing documents. Opposing counsel in their fee motion stated that they are the prevailing party by virtue of the court having granted summary judgment in favor of the association. In the same motion, they go on to say, here, the bulk of the fees incurred relate to the association's successful summary judgment motion. The award of fees should not be allowed to stand when the motion upon which it is predicated is vacated and remanded. And this goes to the cases around the country. During my research for the oral argument, we did, you know, obviously do some research regarding this proposition. And we did cite Bevel in our writ, and which is a ICA case in which finds it does not matter that the lien order constituted a judgment on the merits if they were based on an order that was subsequently vacated. And we acknowledge this is unpublished and not controlling, but it's nonetheless persuasive. In 2019, this court decided Goran Plejo et al. Versus David Lacey et al., SCWC 1225, it's at 439 Pacific 3rd, 176. It's a little bit different. It was a commercial complex litigation case on the Big Island. However, the court did find, we also vacate the award of attorney's fees to the Lacey's party, as it's unclear whether GP LLC will remain the losing party after further adjudication. And I think I touched on this during the questioning as well, but the general proposition has been codified as well at Hawaii Rules of Civil Procedure 60B5, where it provides relief for judgments in exactly the same circumstance we find ourselves here today. When the underlying motion has been vacated, the fee awards will be vacated as well. There's some other cases.
We have a question from Justice Wilson. Justice Wilson.
Thank you. Mr. Rooney, is it your position then that this court should not expect that attorney's fees will be raised as an issue when a motion for summary judgment is appealed? Is it
no.
Would it be your view that it's unnecessary to alert our court where there is a motion for summary judgment granted and there are fees that have been awarded and the court reverses the finding of a summary judgment?
No, Justice Wilson, I don't. And that would be contrary to Hawaii's Rules of Appellate Procedure, is it 28B4, where it's to tersely state the grounds. And I think this was an inadvertent error and one in which you know, in the future it would be, I think, important not to unduly burden the appellate courts and to have raised it. And it was an inadvertent error, but nonetheless one that we could suspect would come before the courts again in the future.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rooney. Thank you.
And in this case, the ICA went out of their way, electing to use their discretion to arrive at an unjust ruling, and this amounts to grave error. And this brings us to the more narrow issue of when the Intermediate Court of Appeals should exercise its discretion and for what purpose. And I think the simple inquiry and answer is to facilitate just rulings and to promote the ends of justice. The ICA's discretion in this case, as we talked about, may arise under Hawaii 28B4. And the reason I feel a need in part to bring this up is because it's the same rule in which opposing counsel will rely upon in support for their positions that the award should be affirmed. But it requires one to strictly adhere to form over substance. And it doesn't address why the court was expressly granted discretion within that rule. As you probably know, the rule states points not presented in accordance with this section will be disregarded, except that the appellate court at its option may notice plain error not presented. And I think the record's clear that Mr. Yoshikawa in his brief presented points of error regarding the motion for summary judgment, but did not explicitly mention the award of attorney's fees. And
Rudy, Justice Wilson has a follow-up question. Justice Wilson.
Thank you. Mr. Rooney, are you now the prevailing party, now that the ICA has reversed the decision of granting the motion for summary judgment?
For circuit court fee purposes and evaluating them, no, Justice. I would say we're back at the same place we started.
All right. Mr. Rooney, anything further at this point?
I'll keep going, Justice, thank you. This inadvertent omission amounts to plain error. However, instead of simply disregarding this omission and remanding it for further proceedings consistent with their decision, as happens quite frequently with the courts, the ICA used their discretion sua sponte to affirm the fee award, even though further proceedings on remand would obviously include that the fee would go away when the underlying basis for it went away. Here, the ICA went out of their way to either notice plain error and rule to the contrary of the what justice demands. And this court previously in Maltavo versus Lopez, 77 Hawaii 282, citing State versus Fox, explaining the plain error rule. In civil cases, the plain error rule is invoked when justice so requires. And three factors have been taken into consideration. Whether or not the issues raised at the trial court require additional facts, whether the resolution will affect the integrity of the trial court's findings, and whether the issue is of great public import. And here,
Rooney, we have a question from Justice Edens.
You know, Mr. Rooney, you said that it was an inadvertent error and, you know, you should have raised the attorney fees in connection with your MSJ issue on appeal. But also you stated that 60B5 seems to be in your back pocket as well. So does somebody really need to raise the attorney fees issue when you have 60B5?
I think both of these issues were decided at the appellate level. I think a 60B5 motion can only be brought at the trial court level, is my understanding. And it wasn't until the Intermediate Court of Appeals ruled that it really gave us the basis to bring a Rule 60B5 motion, Your Honor. The real travesty here is the affirmation and making it not subject to remand on litigation. If the court had, as Hawaii Rules of Appellate Procedure 28 state, disregarded it, they will disregard it, the rule states, I believe. And if they had simply done that and disregarded it, then yes, we could have rightfully brought a motion for relief, a 60B5 motion at the trial court level. But when they were decided concurrently, it makes it difficult to do so, Judge. To sum up this narrow issue, I think we can all agree the law exists to facilitate just outcomes, and therefore not rigid, and nor should it be. That's one important reason the courts do have discretion. In certain circumstances, like Mr. Yoshikawa finds himself now, the ICA's choice to exercise its discretion in affirming the award of attorney's fees for a motion that they concurrently vacated and remanded results in a miscarriage of justice. Rather than defaulting to the general rule, as we were just discussing, that points not presented in accordance with Hawaii Rules of Appellate Procedure 28B4 will be disregarded. The ICA went out of their way to use their discretion in this case to arrive at an unjust outcome. And we submit to this honorable court that such use of judicial discretion amounts to grave error. In conclusion, Mr. Yoshikawa respectfully prays this honorable court find that the fee award and the underlying motion for summary judgment are not sufficiently separate as they're so connected and as it's defined by case law. After all, they are clearly connected. The fee award was predicated and vacated. It was predicated upon the motion for summary judgment that was vacated. And with such a nexus, the associated fee award should be vacated in the interest of justice, or at least disregarded, as provided they will do in Hawaii Rule of Appellate Procedure 28B4. And regardless of where the ICA derived its discretion, to sua sponte affirm the award of fees while simultaneously vacating the underlying motion for summary judgment under either case law, which I think is more persuasive, or Hawaii Rules of 28 Procedure B4, it's just unjust, it's illogical, it's baseless, and it's fundamentally unfair. And we respectfully, it warrants being vacated and remanded. Thank you for your consideration. I ask that any of my remaining time be reserved for rebuttal.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Rooney. We'll hear from Mr. Zalewski at this point.
Thank you, Your Honor. And thank you to this honorable court for this opportunity. The Association of Owners of Kalele Kai respectfully requests that this court affirm in its entirety the Circuit Court's first amended final judgment. I'll address this in two parts. First, the Circuit Court's issuance of summary judgment and injunction against Hitoshi Yoshikawa, and second, the Circuit Court's dismissal of Yoshikawa's counterclaim, cross-claim, and its four orders granting attorney fees. The Circuit Court's summary judgment order and injunction accorded with Rule 56, the project's governing documents and Hawaii law, and should be affirmed. The association's motion for summary judgment presented undisputed evidence as follows. The declaration unambiguously provides that boat moorings shall be restricted to use by boats no larger than 23 feet in length. Before becoming an owner at Kalele Kai, Yoshikawa had actual and constructive knowledge of the restriction. Before purchasing his 49-foot, 4-inch boat, the association informed Yoshikawa it will not and cannot approve any boat over 23 feet in length.
Mr. Yoshikawa, Justice McKenna has a question. Justice McKenna.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Thank you. I'm actually very confused. Did you file an application for certiorari?
We did not, Your Honor.
I thought we were here just on the petitioner's application for certiorari with respect to the attorney's fees.
We are. I would also argue, as has been brought up several times, that as this court does, the law does facilitate just outcomes, the good cause, and the motion for summary judgment was properly granted is one of the reasons for affirming attorney fees.
All right. So I want to be clear that I respectfully disagree with your position. If you did not file an application for certiorari, the only issues before us are those raised in your opposing counsel's petition, which relate to whether or not the attorney's fees award should have been affirmed, or whether a 60B motion should have been precluded by the ICA when it set aside the summary judgment motion. And I do not think that the issue of whether the ICA erred in vacating the summary judgment is before us at this time. So I would ask that you limit your arguments to the issue of whether or not this court should affirm the ICA with respect to the attorney's fees award, as well as whether the ICA had the discretion or abused its discretion by apparently precluding a 60B5 motion on remand in any event.
I'd respectfully submit these issues are intertwined.
Now there's a question from Justice Wilson, Mr. Zalewski. Justice Wilson.
Thank you. Mr. Zalewski, let me ask you to clarify. Are you conceding that in the event that the summary judgment was properly set aside, that there wouldn't be a basis for the award of the attorney's fees that were awarded as to you as a prevailing party on the motion for summary judgment?
No, not at all, Your Honor. There are four attorney fee orders. None of them have been cited at any time by the petitioner. Two of them have nothing to do with summary judgment. The other two orders...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think Mr. Rooney indicated that his statement of issues is meant to pertain to attorney's fees that were awarded as a result of the summary judgment that was granted. So let me be more specific. With respect to that particular summary judgment, if it is a decision of this court that either we're not going to consider it or the ICA was correct in setting aside the summary judgment, would you agree then that the attorney's fees that were awarded for purposes of the summary judgment to you as prevailing party would no longer have a basis?
I'd respectfully distance myself from that statement, in part because there is no single order granting attorney fees pertaining to such summary judgment only. There are two orders that pertain to, in which fees were awarded pertaining to summary judgment. They also pertained to the association having prevailed on Yoshikawa's counterclaim. Those fees were generated as a result of the assumption statute, or properly awarded under the assumption statutes, HRS 6.
Sorry to interrupt you, but let's assume, which I think your point is, that it's unclear what portion of the attorney's fees award pertains to summary judgment. Are you suggesting we should remand so that that could be determined by the circuit court? That is, the extent to which the attorney's fees are a result of the summary judgment motion?
Respectfully not. I believe and just to finish that thought, to the extent that the two orders pertain to summary judgment, part of those orders pertain to the association having prevailed on Yoshikawa's argument that he didn't have to pay assessments. That was not appealed. That was also part of the summary judgment. The ICA didn't consider that. In any event, there is no single order that pertains to summary judgment. Summary judgment fees only.
Justice Edens has a question, Mr. Zaleski.
Mr. Zaleski, following up on what Justice Wilson just said, I look at your two motions for attorney's fees, and I don't see any breakout between the counterclaim and the cross-claim and the MSJ. So how are we to determine if we rule in Mr. Rooney's favor, what amount of that roughly $100,000 attorney's fee order relates to the counterclaim and the cross-claim that he's not appealing to us? It would seem that it would have to be remanded because you in your attorney's fees motions didn't break it out. Am I correct there?
Right. At the time, we obviously weren't aware of how the ICA would rule. That this would be, I guess, if that type of ruling was deemed appropriate, the circuit court would again have to go through, I believe, a very detailed determination, or there'd have to be separate motions as they pertain to what the fees were allocable to. Again, the dismissal order has not been appealed from. The protective orders has not been appealed from. And I also believe that with regard to the attorney fees, that the ICA did make a correct decision with regard to affirming the attorney fee awards, albeit I'm not going to argue that the summary judgment order and the attorney fee orders, to the extent it pertains to summary judgment, are sufficiently separate. But as we've noted, the Sprague decision, this court has held, that's 102 Hawaii at 196, that an appellate court is given full discretion to disregard issues not set forth in compliance with Rule 28B4. And here, There was no point of error that pertained to the dismissal order or the attorney fee orders. Indeed, the briefs, there was no discernible argument whatsoever to attorney fees anywhere in the briefs. And finally, as was noted, the ICA did not exercise its discretion to note plain error. So we have two separate bases, 28B4 and 28B7, upon which, and the Sprague decision and analogous case law, that the attorney fee order should stand under as an exercise of the ICA's reasonable discretion. And I do want to talk briefly about the summary judgment order, because
when we talk about reasonable use of the ICA's discretion, is in your view, I presume it was a reasonable use of their discretion to foreclose a 60B5 motion?
I'll be quite candid. I did not analyze that issue. What I looked at is the questioning of the attorney fee award and also the dismissal order that has not been appealed from. And the reason I consider that significant is the dismissal order dismissed Yoshikawa's counterclaim for breach of contract, which alleged third-party beneficiary a breach of contract. Judge Nakasone dismissed that order with prejudice. So, and that's an underpinning upon which the ICA concluded in its memorandum decision that there is a fact issue in this case. That Yoshikawa did not have and cannot assert a third-party beneficiary claim, and that has not been before this court at this time. So that's, I guess, just to try to elaborate. That's how these. The ICA's decision on the whole, although I agree that attorney fees should be that portion of the memorandum opinion should be affirmed. I believe the summary judgment ruling didn't contemplate what Judge Nakasone did in her dismissal order that takes out the underpinnings upon which the summary judgment order was set aside.
I'd like to direct you back to the attorney's fees issue. Did you raise Rule 28B in your answering brief, or did you suggest to the ICA that they should find that this issue had been waived?
We addressed summary judgment only. We based based upon the sole point of appeal by Mr. Yoshikawa was summary judgment. And there was no reference to any of the other interlocutory orders.
All right. So it wasn't raised by you in your answering brief, nor by him in your understanding in his opening brief, correct?
It was, yes. And I'm confident it was not raised by Mr. Yoshikawa at any time, including in his reply brief. Just to get back to the two bases upon which summary judgment was set aside by the ICA, aside from the third-party beneficiary theory that cannot be asserted in the future.
I'm sorry, Mr. Zaleski, Justice McKenna and Justice Wilson have a question. Justice McKenna.
Thank you. Mr. Zaleski, you indicate that, actually Mr. Rooney has clarified that the only attorney's fees award he seeks to have set aside is the one on November 5th, 2015, awarding $79,514.50. And that motion was based on, that award was based on your motion August 28th, 2015. And in that motion, you had requested $84,093 in attorney's fees on the grounds that you prevailed by virtue of the court having granted summary judgment. And so it appears that motion was based on the grant of summary judgment, and the court denied some hours saying that it wasn't really related to the summary judgment and reduced the fee award by about $5,000 to $79,000. And so therefore I'm having difficulty understanding why that is not the fee award at issue here, in terms of that was the award of fees for your prevailing on summary judgment, which was the summary judgment order was then set aside by the ICA.
Well, that's correct in part. It was also based upon our assumption claim with regard to the dismissal order, and that's set forth in our motion for attorney fees, as you correctly noted, dated or filed August 28, 2015. There's discussion about the assumption statute and application assumption statute beginning at page 4 of the memorandum in support of that motion. It is a mixed order that resulted by Judge Nakasone. I believe the reasons, or at least the primary reason she discounted the award, was doing her reasonable analysis. I don't believe it was tied to the order, the dismissal order, or the MSJ specifically. She, you know, engaged in that inquiry and analysis.
Mr. Zaleski, we have a question from Justice Wilson. Justice Wilson.
Thank you. Thank you, CJ. So, Mr. Zaleski, I'm still reaching for what your relief is here, because regardless of how you interpret the orders that granted attorney's fees, a significant part of it clearly was as a result of summary judgment. So if your position is that there should be no adjustment now of the attorney's fees award, despite the fact that summary judgment was set aside, do you have any authority for that? Wouldn't that mean that this court would be affirming an attorney fee award without a basis? And do we have any legal authority to do that? The Miyamoto case you cited, I'm sure you would concede, doesn't stand for that proposition. There was sort of the opposite, that if there is a underlying lien, it's a result of an attorney's fee action, that it would be attorney's fees couldn't be awarded if the lien is set aside.
I don't disagree with that if this court were to conclude that attorney fees attributable to the summary judgment award, to the extent it was related to the order that we just discussed, that is something that would require further proceedings at circuit court. My point is, and what I'm trying to say, and I'll just be very brief, I believe there are three reasons why the attorney fee award should be awarded, and that is, respectfully submit that the Judge Nakasone's summary judgment order was proper. Second reason is Mr. Yoshikawa did not appeal the dismissal order or any of the attorney fees. And then thirdly, it's Sprague versus California Pacific Bakers and insurance. Here, that just involved non-compliance with Rule 28B4. Here, it's also non-compliance with Rule 28B7. There's no discernible argument whatsoever regarding any attorney fees. That was the four corners. The opening brief is the four corners upon which we filed our answering brief. We had no notice of what they were appealing. Had they cited specific orders, we could have addressed them. They didn't. And we respectfully request, though, and just to reiterate, to carry out, and I believe we do all are interested in what will happen in terms of good cause and just in the interest of justice, should this be remanded to the circuit court. You have no third-party beneficiary theory that Mr. Yoshikawa can assert, because Judge Nakasone dismissed that claim with prejudice. And then the only other basis in the ICA memorandum opinion for setting aside the summary judgment order is estoppel by acquiescence, which was never raised in circuit court. In fact, no affirmative defenses were raised in response to the motion for summary judgment. The only argument Mr. Yoshikawa made was that extrinsic evidence should be used to ascertain the intent of an agreement, namely the declaration and this restriction. This restriction, Judge Nakasone and the ICA concluded, were unambiguous. Therefore, that extrinsic evidence is inadmissible. I think it'd be a real quandary back in circuit court, given that what is going to proceed in terms of the case, I guess we have to file another summary judgment motion because Mr. Yoshikawa does not have a third party beneficiary claim. He can't. That's been dismissed with prejudice. And Mr. Yoshikawa clearly did not appeal that. The ICA so concluded. And there's no argument that the dismissal order should be set aside.
Mr. Zaleski, Justice McKenna has a question. Justice McKenna.
So in terms of the dismissal order, Mr. Zaleski, that is the dismissal of the counterclaim. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. So with respect to the attorney's fees award, you're indicating that your attorney's fees award included your fees in obtaining the dismissal of that counterclaim, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
But without the dismissal of the counterclaim, you would not have gotten summary judgment, correct?
I don't...
If the counterclaim was pending, remained pending, how could you have gotten a final judgment in your favor?
To be very frank, I would have to think that through. The counterclaim was filed the day after the hearing on the motion for summary judgment. It was not.
Wasn't that the deadline that had been set for their answer, that you had agreed to continue their date by which they had to respond to your first amended complaint? And it was the day after the summary judgment motion?
No, I think they had more time than that, but they filed it. So the way it worked is at the hearing itself, the point was made, and actually it was Judge Nakasone saying, I believe it was three times during that hearing, where in your opposition are the affirmative defenses? That occurred. That was, I believe, April 28, 2015, April 29, 2000. And then Mr. Revere cited 13 affirmative defenses by name only during the hearing for the first time. The next day, he filed an answer and counterclaim. We did not tell him or instruct him to file anything at any time. He asked for an extension and we gave it. But Judge Nakasone very clearly said, you have this obligation to put it in your opposition if you have affirmative defenses. They were never raised. In any event, we subsequently filed a motion to dismiss the counterclaim. It was granted. I'd have to look back at all the reasons for that. I don't think they were necessarily... tied to Judge Nakasone's ruling, except with respect to the restriction being deemed unambiguous, that the ICA also concluded, therefore precluding this extrinsic evidence that the opposition was based on.
So one of the first amended final judgment that was the subject of the appeal included the counterclaim, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Dismissing the counterclaim. So you're saying that the dismissal of the counterclaim was not appealed, although if dismissal of the counterclaim was required for there to be a final judgment in your favor, it appears that that is clearly an underlying order also that had to have been set aside with the summary judgment order.
Well, I appreciate that question. And I think that kind of illustrates in rather clear terms what is being advocated by Mr. Yoshikawa, that basically Rule 28 doesn't matter, that you don't have to appeal things. And we should anticipate in our answering brief to basically address issues and points that were never raised. But there is no hint, just like the attorney fee orders, there is no hint of, there is no reference to the dismissal order anywhere in Mr. Yoshikawa's appellate papers.
Okay. All right. So then perhaps the issue is whether a plain error would need to apply to the underlying orders that led to the summary judgment. I think I'll have to ask Mr. Rooney that. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And just briefly to respond to that, maybe I'm looking at this too simplistically, but I believe that this restriction being unambiguous, Judge Nakasone and the ICA having so concluded, is is very relevant to all of these answers, because both the counterclaim and the MSJ were and the opposition MSJ were based entirely on extrinsic evidence that are inadmissible. So unless there's other questions, I just wanted to briefly cover a few points that the ICA, in finding fact issues, based it on claims or defenses that were non-existent and weren't raised by the parties. And that is one reason why the attorney fee awards should be affirmed. The other reason being, again, the non-compliance with rules 28B4, 28B7, and the fact that the ICA properly exercised its recognized discretion under Sprague and other case law to affirm the dismissal order and the attorney fee orders.
Very well. Anything further at this time for the court, Mr. Zaleski?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
All right. We'll turn back to Mr. Rooney for his rebuttal. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chief Justice. Try to keep it quick. Opposing counsel is arguing form over substance here, and clearly doesn't result in a just outcome. Here, strict adhesion to Hawaii Rules of Appellate Procedure 28B4 results in a manifest injustice that the court should employ their discretion to remedy and arrive at a just disposition of the claims. Respectfully, Mr. Yoshikawa prays the honorable court correct this injustice by vacating the associated fee awards. And to Justice McKenna's point, we're interested in a just outcome here. Mr. Yoshikawa is. So if on remand, the appellate court would like to review the record again for additional plain error, we would be amenable to that. That's all I have.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chief Justice, may I ask a question? Mr. Rooney, what is the, you only, the ICA's judgment on appeal says that paragraphs A and B of the final judgment are set aside and C, D, and E are affirmed. And I believe only one of those is actually the attorney's fees, and one is the dismissal of, so you have no issue with the dismissal of the counterclaim and dismissal of the third party complaint at this point? It's just the attorney's fees that you are asserting in this application?
Correct, Your Honor. I think we have some issues with them. However, we simply asserted the issue of attorney's fees associated with a motion for summary judgment. So at this point, we do take issue with them, and if the Intermediate Court of Appeals wants to review them again for plain error, certainly we would not be opposed to that. We're not asking for that. We didn't come to the court asking for that here today, and consequently.
But you're by the same token, I asked Mr. Zaleski, the issues before us on certiorari. Your opposing counsel did not file an application for certiorari as to the setting aside of the summary judgment. And so that issue is not properly before us. By the same token, your application for certiorari, it appears it's only with respect to the attorney's fees and does not, is there anything in your application for certiorari that contests the grant of the dismissal of your third party complaint as well as your counterclaim?
No, Justice McKenna.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Anything further at this time, Mr. Rooney?
No, sir.
All right. Well, thank you to both of our attorneys for your arguments here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Thank you.
Ua ho'o ku'u ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolo kolo ki'e ki'e hano hano o ka moko'aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.